Oh, it offends me to the soul to hear a robustious, periwig-painted fellow tear a passion to tatters, to very rags, to split the ears of the groundlings, who for the most part are capable of nothing but inexplicable dumb shows and noise.
Well, Henny, you better hang on to your bear bodkin, because you're going to hate this. It's John Malden and D. Quillen, your hosts for the Inexplicable Dumb Show, starting now.
Did you have a good Labor Day break? Were you nice and rested from your...
Yeah, man, I had a... Yeah, yeah.
Nice little day off.
Nice little day off, yep.
Yep.
Yep, restful.
Anything major happen in your life there?
Just some football and a new bed. Yeah.
New bed, really?
Yeah, new bed, yeah, new bed.
Really?
Yes. New mattress and box spring.
What'd you do with the old one?
The old one got put in a truck and sent down to Florida.
Oh, to the other house?
Right.
Yeah, okay, good. All right.
Yeah, it's on wait for Hannah.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, I heard Hannah's coming.
She's come before.
I know. So, yeah, mine was just like, you know, day around the pool. You know, yeah. A bunch of kids running around the pool.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, kind of like a club, maybe.
It kind of was, yeah. Kind of like. I mean, you know, Ian was the only boy there, you know. So.
Wow.
I mean, it was all family, but, you know.
All? It just.
Yeah. Yeah. We had a good time, though.
Yeah.
A lot of conversation. So anyway, I called this one.
How did things come out?
Very well. Let me just tell you.
Good.
Very, very well.
Things.
Yeah, things came out great.
Things ran well, didn't
yeah.
they?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, they sure did. Anyway, I've called this episode Juzu.
Okay.
And we'll talk about that a little bit later on the episode, like we always do. This week, we are going to talk to Jeffrey Sherman of the Alabama Shakespeare Festival.
Outstanding.
And we're going to talk about their new season that they've got coming up, because they have not opened anything yet. And I think, I may be wrong about this, but I think we're going to have some breaking news from the Alabama Shakespeare Festival coming up.
Whoa.
To you right here.
Scoopage.
On the Inexplicable Dumb Show. And then what is this about jeans? Did you get new jeans or something?
No. I've got your defense, my friend.
Defense.
I've come to your defense. I have found something that is going to help you out.
What do I? Well, okay, we'll talk about it a little later on. That's okay. I think that's all we're going to do this week.
Okay, sounds good.
So let's get on with it.
All right.
Carlin effect. Go.
We use the sun to make electricity. Then we use the electricity to operate sun lamps and tanning machines.
Thus saith George.
Thus ends his catechism.
Hi, I am someone you will probably never meet. Yet I ask you to take time
to think about people you don't know but need your help. Children, some of them. And they don't all play, in the gutter, of course.
Well, maybe if it's called for.
These men, women, and yes, even the children are professional actors. They want and need your time, money, and support.
For just pennies a second, you can enjoy the fruits of their labor. Make sure they know you heard about them on the Inexplicable Dumb Show. They may look at you funny, but that doesn't matter. It's for the children.
It's for the children. It's time once again for some deep fried theater!
Hey, John, we're talking to the Alabama Shakespeare Festival again.
Oh, outstanding.
Yeah, but this time we have the head cheese.
What?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. We have got Jeffrey Sherman.
Oh, well, welcome, Jeffrey. How are you?
I am fine, although I haven't been called cheese in a long time.
Way to start an interview, too.
Yeah, I know. Right, I know. Well, I thought that sounded better than artistic director, but...
I'll survive. Don't worry.
Okay, good deal.
Quit insult the man right off the bat.
I know, right off the bat. Well, we strive for the best here at the Inexplicable Dumb Show. Jeffrey, how's everything going down there in Montgomery?
It's horrible. What can I say? I mean, everything we do turns to... No, it's actually going really well. We are in the process of firing up the new season, and that's always brings with it some... interesting events. But no, things are going very, very well. We had a good season last year. Over the past three or four seasons, we've increased our audience by about 40%, so can't complain.
Yeah, no, that's excellent news. Now, the press release that I'm looking at here says the 08-09 season has three world premieres for the Alabama Shakespeare Festival. Is that right?
Yeah, it does. Yeah, it's funny when you run a regional theater, we all talk about title recognition, and we talk about the plays that our audiences should see and the plays they want to see, and we try and put together a mix that will stimulate and entertain and move and all those things. And then if you're me, you look at the numbers of people who are coming into the theater for a specific type of play. And in looking at the numbers, what I realized was that even if it was a straight play, it didn't really seem to matter whether it was a very well-known title or a title that nobody had heard of. We were getting a very similar number of people in bottoms in seats. So I decided that I might as well do three world premieres.
Sure.
Rather than three ex off Broadway pieces or Broadway, I might as well do what we have been doing here for quite a while, and that is continue to encourage members of the Southern Writers Project and actually produce the plays rather than just giving them readings and workshops and going through that whole developmental process and then doing nothing with them. So that's why we've got three new plays.
Well, I'm sorry, but I'm really glad that, I want to give you kudos for kind of doing the new work, but also sort of stacking the deck, since you're in Alabama, and I understand one of these new plays has something to do with a little man named Bear Bryant.
Yeah, we've heard about him.
Yeah, somebody asked me yesterday, when did you first hear about Bear Bryant? And I said, well, probably about, I don't know, 3 or 4 years ago. When did I arrive in Alabama? Which was not the right thing to say.
Right. Yeah.
I have relatives, or at least in-laws, up north. And we were just up there a week or so ago. And the first thing that all of these fellows said was, hey, you're doing this play about Bear Bryant. And I said to them, yeah, well, this is the first time you actually expressed any interest in my theater whatsoever in the past 3 years. You mean you're actually going to come and see a play? And the chances are, I think, that they might. Yes. The whole Bear Bryant project was something that I believe in what I call geo-specific theater. I believe in wherever I've been, actually. I've tried to do plays that have some reverberation in the community in which the theater sits. Because very often those plays, if they're good, have reverberations around the country. For instance, G's Band, the play that we produce as part of our Southern Writers Project by Elizabeth Gregory Wilder, last season has now ended up being done in Cleveland and Denver and Chicago, across the country at a large number of major regional theaters because it's a good play. But who would have thought on the front end that a little tone poem about a group of African-American quilt makers would have the wider reverberation that G's Band had. And I'm hoping that, obviously, that something like Bear Country is going to have a wider reverberation than just here in Montgomery. Single ticket sales started a couple of days ago, and we're getting sold really fast.
Yeah, I would imagine. So you got to be careful how you market it, though. People might think it's the second coming. You know what I'm saying? Having been a lifelong Alabama fan and having gotten my degree from there, I understand exactly what that means. I can remember watching the television footage of his funeral as a kid.
Really?
Yeah. Wow. It was on statewide television. They shut every television station down and covered it. Not kidding. It was a day of mourning for the state of Alabama.
Pretty wonderful.
Yeah, it is. I mean,
so you're going to have a wax effigy of Bear Bryant in the lobby so people can get their pictures taken for X number of dollars?
Well, actually, I think we're going to have a hat, and then, they can wear the hat and have a picture. No, I don't know. I've learned so much about the guy since we've been working on the project that I can understand, I think, a lot of what the state felt about him. It's a pretty extraordinary man.
He really was.
So what are these? To be fair, right? You're going to have to do a musical about Pat Dye or something.
I don't think that's necessary, John.
I just
It's the Alabama Shakespeare Festival.
Yeah, I can't make that kind of value judgment. I leave it to those greater wisdom.
Well, that's a good call because that means we could continue the interview. I'm only kidding. So what are these other world premieres that you got going on there? We've talked about the Bear Bryant play. What are the other ones that you got?
We've got two plays with the word house in them. We've got the fall of the house, which is a pretty remarkable piece about the last days of Edgar Allan Poe. And if I would have tried to explain any more about it, I would lose you and your listeners. It's suffice to say, the standard of writing is up there with other likes of Tom Stoppard, I think.
Wow.
It's an American playwright. And I believe that it's one of the strongest plays that's come through our Southern Writers Project over the past couple of years. We should, by rights, have produced it last year and didn't have the space, and so we're producing it this year. And then the piece by this newest piece by Elizabeth Gregory Wilder, which is called The Furniture of Home, which is about the effects of Katrina. Interestingly, we workshopped a piece of hers under the same title last year, which was actually about New Orleans, and it didn't quite get there, and so everybody went back to the drawing board, and she came up with a piece about this place on the Gulf called Bayou La Batre, or something like that. It, depending on your accent, you can make it sound more like what it really is. But that's as close as I can get. And it's a story of, it's a very, very intimate story of one family and their relationship to, some detritus that washes up in their backyard, from the aftermath of Katrina. Mm-hmm. And it's also about the rebuilding that's going on the coast and how good and how bad that can be when your backyard is being torn up to put a new condominium in there or something. Mm-hmm. Nice play, very funny, very touching, and I think perhaps a play that will, like Bear Country, have life elsewhere in this country. Though that's not the reason we're doing them, of course. I'm doing them for the local audience. So those are the three.
Okay, those are three, now,
I think, very interesting plays.
And several of those, in some form or fashion or other, came from the Southern Writers Project. Either they are writers that have worked or have had their work featured as part of the Southern Writers Project, or have come through that project themselves as part of that play. Is that kind of what I understood?
Correct. Two of them are commissions. The Bear Bryant and Elizabeth Peace were commissioned by us. And the third came through the developmental process of the Southern Writers Project.
So then what is happening with the Southern Writers Project this season?
This season? Well, I'm surprised you are. you said smiling. We've commissioned a new play by Pearl Clegg. Some would know her as Pearl Clegg. I always thought it was Clegg, and I discovered it was Clegg when we met comparatively recently. A new piece, which is as yet untitled, and is about, it's about the 60s, and it's about an African-American family, more, I would suggest, upper middle class in Montgomery, and their aspirant debutante daughters, who discover the civil rights movement in Selma and the conflict that results from that discovery. I think it sounds a fascinating, fascinating play, and we talked at least an outline about it, and we're in the process of getting hopefully a first draft before too long. In addition, we will be producing a workshop of a new musical by Douglas Cohen and Cheryl Davis called Barnstormer, which is about the first African-American aviatrix. I love that word. Don't you love that word?
I do aviatrix. Love that word. Always love that
Why
word.
You can't say female aviator? I don't know. Anyway, aviatrix. It has all the connotations. Does this show go out to young people?
Oh, yes.
I should keep it clean, right? Okay.
Yeah.
then I won't go any further down that road. But that's the, and there are several other scripts that we have under commission. We've actually commissioned two plays, two playwrights to write, new work about the sesquicentennial of the Civil War here in Montgomery. You know, it's going to be 150 years, in 2011, and I wanted to look at some of the stories of the small people, the other people. For instance, there was a guy who was making a flag maker making some Confederate flags who in downtown Montgomery, who was in fact feeding information to the Northern forces at the same time as making the Confederate flag. I mean, interesting little, tiny little stories like that. Yeah. And we pulled together some local historians and sat them down and had this long conversation, which we, over two meetings, which we taped. And those stories, we are hoping, will provide the basis for two playwrights, and I'm not going to say who they are just at the moment, one Caucasian and one African-American, to look at those exact plots and let them stimulate the playwright into telling some sort of historical story in a historical context using all those same characters, and to have both of those plays playing probably on subsequent nights, so that you can have a look at the same events and the same stories, but from two, one assumes, slightly different perspectives.
Hmm.
Because I don't see any other way of dealing with the Civil War unless you can do that, because it's such an emotive event. You know, Civil Wars tend to be that.
Mm-hmm.
He said with his tongue firmly in front of his they just are. I mean, it's just one of those things. And particularly in the South. And so when, the idea came to us of talking about the subject, I decided that we needed to look at it from more than one perspective. So that's going to be hopefully one of those pieces at least will come into, this, 2009, SWP. But there are other things we're doing too. Why don't you ask me about that?
Well, I was gonna wait for a pause in there and jump in and ask you about your new intern company. I think that's kind of fascinating.
Yeah.
So what can you tell me about that?
Well, what can I tell you about that? I'm not sure. They're arriving today. You know, many theaters across the country, run both, either MFA or BFA programs and intern companies simultaneously. We historically had worked with the University of Alabama on a Master of Fine Arts program for performers, stage managers, and unusually theater managers. And in looking at this, we discovered that it was costing a little more than we would like, and have been trying to work to find ways of paying for it. And it became apparent that we might have to, or the university might have to put the Master of Fine Arts program on hiatus for a while. However, we're a classical theater producing large scale work and need, access to hopefully actors that we believe in. On a non-equity basis, to be able to come and play some of the smaller roles and work with us on the large cast plays. So when it became apparent that we would be supporting effectively half an MFA program this season, I thought, okay, well, we might be able to get away with this, but it would be better if we were also if we had a number of young actors in here on a slightly different basis. And so we decided to try starting off a 1 year intern company, which will employ young actors for a year, and they will end up with their equity card at the end of it. No degree or anything, but they will have gone through a similar process, similar teaching process, similar rubbing shoulders with really fine classical actors and modern actors process. And also some experience in musical theater. So we went to New York and auditioned some people, and several hundred people came in to audition. They auditioned first for our casting director, and then I went in there personally, and we went through the callbacks and ended up with six very, very talented young actors. So we'll see how that works out. It'll be similar to the MFA program, and I'll be working jowl by jowl with the MFA candidates who are currently in their second year, although not always doing exactly the same shows.
So it is going to work in conjunction with the MFA program for right now, is that?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay,
Yeah, and as I said to the MFA, MFA company, I want our current MFA company to have exactly the same experience as their predecessors. That their experience won't be diluted in any way.
Right.
There must be the addition of these half a dozen other young actors.
So the one thing that I have not heard mentioned yet, and just as a reminder, you are the Alabama Shakespeare Festival. I haven't heard any mention of Shakespeare yet. Are you doing any this year?
That's what I was fishing for in my last comment. Yeah, we are. We're doing a very interesting classical season, I think. We're doing Comedy of Errors and Othello with hopefully a really fine actor who's been here before, who I've worked with over the years, playing Othello, although, you know, many have slipped twixt cup and lip. We hope that people will still be available when we get there. And we're going to do Dumas' Three Musketeers. So two Shakespeare's, one almost French guy, sort of writing a little bit later. And that will form the core of our rep, together with obviously the modern plays that will peek their little heads in on occasion. But Comedy of Errors and Othello, two only, and then next year I'm hoping to go back to begin to increase the number back up to a reasonable three or four for, as you said, the Alabama Shakespeare Festival. What I'm trying to do here is develop our young audiences. You know, we've increased the number of young people who are coming in under our school fest auspices to this past season about 54,000 and change, which is a significant number of people who are now coming in from Mississippi and Louisiana, as well as obviously the entire state of Alabama, parts of Florida and Georgia. What I'm hoping to be able to do is to extend our time commitment to those young audiences so that we can ultimately get back to the summer festival presentation of Shakespeare for the traveling audience that I've had to partially sacrifice in order to develop the young audience material and timing. In other words, the schools here in Alabama, as I'm sure you know, they've disappeared by May. Unlike other parts of the country where it's certainly early to mid-June, before they break out for the summer. So I'm looking at other states, particularly Florida, who do continue into June, to see whether we can extend our school's audiences into June and then convert into, change the shows into to entertain the adult audiences. Because what I did last year was to present all of the rep plays to young audiences first. They opened to School Fest and then stayed in School Fest mode until we opened all of them in subsequent weeks to adult audiences in May. And if I could push that ultimately over the next year or two into June, then we would actually be able to function for School Fest right the way through from January into June, and then bring the adult audiences in June and July, and possibly even into August. August, which would then reestablish that traveling audience commitment that this theater's always had.
That sounds like a tall order. I mean, you sounds like you got your hands full on that. I mean, that's it.
Well,
it's great.
It isn't, interestingly, if we can sustain the level of commitment from the schools, because they seem to be being highly entertained. A woman brought a party, a couple of busloads in from Mississippi, and was so taken with, I think it was Cymbeline, that she wanted to bring the entire school back this season. Unfortunately, we don't have 1,000 seats or 1,200 in one go, but nonetheless, I think that we could probably do a deal with her.
Yeah.
So it's that kind of thing. As long as we're doing good work, I think that we can probably get some, we can continue that commitment for and from the schools.
Excellent. And just as a point of reference, Alabama Shakespeare Festival was my first exposure to Shakespeare as a middle school kid.
Oh.
Yep. Sure was.
That's great.
I grew up in Huntsville. We traveled down and I saw a production of King Lear that I'll never forget. Wow. It was a gorgeous production. But John was about to say something as well. Sorry.
Well, I guess I'm the opposite side of the coin here. So if I don't want new work and I don't want Shakespeare.
Ah.
What does the Alabama Shakespeare offer?
Mm.
Say I want something with a little pitch to it. Some hoofing, maybe.
Some rhythm.
I say get on a boat with some cows, right?
Yeah.
But that aside, I would suggest possibly this piece called Three More Divas, which is about to open up here towards the end of September. This is one of those rare occasions where we're actually presenting a week of extraordinary singers who are coming in to do everything from opera to through jazz to blues to Broadway. It's been touring now off and on for, I guess, the past couple of years, most recently in Toronto and I believe Denver. And is exactly what it sounds like. I mean, if you remember the three tenors, and there were the three mole tenors, and now there are three mole divas. And that's what the piece is. Then we're doing the, Broadway version of Christmas Carol. It's Christmas Carol the musical, which was done at, Madison Square Garden for probably about a decade. It's a musical version of Christmas Carol, the best way to put it. It's a little different from what people are going to expect. We don't have, the funds, and neither actually probably would I be interested in producing, the 62 actor version that was done at Madison Square Garden, because I wouldn't have anywhere to put them.
Right.
So we're obviously paring it down slightly, but the music is it's Alan Menken. I mean, the piece is a really enjoyable and I think rather good adaptation. I did my own of Christmas Carol. I mean, hasn't every artistic director in the country some years ago, and it played at various places and enjoyably, and I've directed it umpty times. But this is significantly different, and I think from my own personal perspective as a Brit, it was adapted by another Brit, alas, passed away, Mike Cochrane. But it's a pretty good adaptation, and I'm looking forward to doing it. Then we're doing Charlotte's Web for young audiences, not with music. And then finally, at the end of the season, there's this other French piece, by I forget exactly the guy's name. Anyway, it's called Les Mis or Les Misérables, and that's going to round out the season. That's something that I've been trying to get the rights to for about 3 years. And a friend of mine, in Utah got the very first regional production and had enormous fun with it. And I've asked him to come in and direct our version with the same choreographer as well, who recently actually did our production of West Side Story. So, not a small piece, he said.
That's what I've heard.
Again, yeah, right.
It's a pretty big show about a loaf of bread.
It is, isn't it? Yeah.
Yes, yeah, it sure is, isn't it? Yeah. It's a show that I want us to do because we've had some considerable success with, we had some success with Beauty and the Beast and Peter Pan and most recently with a very, very fine West Side Story. And if you look around the country, you will note that, for instance, the Oregon Shakespeare Festival is about to open its new season with The Music Man, which is something of a departure for them. But I think that what we're all discovering is that there is a need for a little extra. for our audiences. And that's a long philosophic discussion that we probably don't have time to go into here. And at some other point, we perhaps could, because I find it very, very interesting, to deal with, I used to be a Shakespeare purist. I was brought up with the Royal Shakespeare Company when John Barton and Trevor Nunn and Ferb were running it. And I felt a certain way about the production of and what a Shakespeare company should do. And then when I took over this place and saw where the audiences were, in terms of numbers, and its relevance to the community in which it sits, I realized that I needed to go in a slightly different direction. And that's what we've been doing. And that has resulted in increasing and solidly increasing audiences overall. So, but one wishes it were for, the namesake of the theater. That's what I'm trying to work on right now, is how do we reestablish the contact that that you had to Leah at the age of 12, and that I had to, I don't know, probably even someone I was dreaming or something when I was 10, how do we reestablish the delight in that work? And sometimes it, you don't get it immediately. You go to the theater and you see the play and Shakespeare, and you don't have to understand everything. I think that that's the, we've become such a literal society that we expect every single thing to be as clear as crystal. Mm. And it doesn't have to be. And I'm not even sure that Shakespeare was, that clear to his contemporary audience. I mean, I strive, and I think we've succeeded here in making Shakespeare as crystal clear as we possibly can. But there's a whole vocabulary that you're holding at arm's length that you have to trust, and trust that the characters will bring you through the story and ultimately give you a delightful experience. And that's something I think that no other playwright can actually give an audience. But in trying to reinculcate that into a modern audience, I'm interested in any help that anybody would like to give us.
And so you can reach Jeffrey at
suggestions sent to
Jeffrey. It's,
I mean, it, that it,
no, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Carry on. I stopped talking.
Okay. Well, I was going to say, it's been an absolute delight to have you on the show, and we will, I mean, because you guys have got so much going on, we will definitely be checking in over the course of the season and seeing how things are going, but it definitely sounds like things are going in your direction down in Montgomery, to tie it back to the question that I asked at the beginning. It sounds like things are going fairly well for the Alabama Shakespeare Festival, and that's fantastic. We wish you the best of luck.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you. Hey, T.
Yeah.
When we don't have guests in studio, how do we talk to them?
Interesting question, John. We use a program called Skype.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
What is that about?
Well, it's a piece of software that you can download it. It's free to download. You can use it to talk to other Skype users over the internet for free, or you can make cheap phone calls to phones and mobile phones worldwide through the Skype Out program.
Okay, and how would I, perchance, acquire Skype?
Well, what you can do is you can go to inexplicabledumbshow.com and click on the download Skype button on the left-hand side of the page.
It's as easy as that?
It's as easy as that.
Wow. I'll go do that right now.
Want to stay current with the Inexplicable Dumb Show?
It's quick and it's easy and it's free.
Click the subscribe button at inexplicabledumbshow.com
and you'll never have to miss an episode.
If you love the Inexplicable Dumb Show like I do, don't be shy about it. Go ahead and wear your feelings on your sleeve, or at least your chest. Head on over to our Cafe Press store and wear your support for the IDS proudly. www.cafepress.com/dumbshow.
Hey, man.
What?
Hey, did you hear you hear the news?
What news? What
you know, the news. What? It's the news about.
What?
Well, apparently it is, if you're a cheating male, which apparently it's just men that cheat.
Mm-hmm.
If you're a cheating male, it is now, there's a scientific study that says it is a genetic variant, which means, fellas out there, you're programmed that way.
Hmm. Did they say which one?
Well,
I'm wondering if you can get out of one gene and get into another.
Well, if you're cheating, yes, you're getting out of one gene, probably.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's true.
Let's see. The first time science has shown a direct link between a man's genes and his aptitude for monogamy.
I've always thought that. I mean, you can just look at a guy. Yeah. You know, what kind of gene, you know?
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. The presence of the gene variant or allele also seems predictive of whether men get married or live with women without getting married.
Hmm. Oh, I see.
Men with two copies of the allele had twice the risk of experiencing marital dysfunction with a threat of divorce during the last year compared to men carrying one or no copies, said Hasse Wallum, a behavioral geneticist at the Karolinska Institute in Stockholm.
Wow.
Who led the story.
Jeez.
Women married to men with one or two copies of the allele scored lower on average on how satisfied they were with a relationship compared to women married to men with no copies.
Does it say anything about what the satisfaction has anything to deal with?
I mean, are they talking about just overall satisfaction or?
Yeah, I don't think it's sexual. I just think it's like overall
you're not
happiness
happy
in a relationship.
Okay.
Yeah,
all
yeah.
Right. Okay.
You perv.
I'm just saying. I mean, we're talking about genes here. Come on.
The scientists studied men because the hormone being examined is known to play a larger role in their brains than in women's brains. So women can have this gene, I guess. This variant. But apparently it does not affect them as much as it affects men.
Oh, okay.
The findings set off a debate about whether people should conduct genetic tests to find out whether potential mates are bad marriage prospects.
Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm.
Several independent scientists mm-hmm. called the discovery remarkable and elegant, but disagreed over whether such information ought to be used in making personal decisions about love and marriage.
Yeah. Well, look at it this way. If they did that, the chances of us actually breeding that gene out are pretty good.
Yeah.
So,
I guess.
Yeah.
I mean...
What was
that?
That
if every
Ethan
woman.
Hawk movie? What was that one? The
Gattaca.
Yeah, Gattaca.
Yeah.
I'm telling you, it's right there.
But I mean, that would be only if every woman, every couple,
had
this
children.
Test.
That's right. Yeah. Or yeah. Okay.
So.
Yeah. In other words, they'd have to mandate it in order for.
Right.
Yeah.
And then you kind of.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
Brave new world on you all of a sudden.
Yep.
Wallen said the presence of the allele increased the risk of conjugal discord. Wow, that's an interesting phrase for bad conjugal discord.
Yeah.
But that
that's a great name for a band, though.
Yes. Good night, Cleveland. We're conjugal discord. And we're fucked. Or not. We'd like to, but it doesn't work out. I want to fuck everybody. But I can't.
Or nobody.
Or nobody.
At all.
I can't make up my mind. We're conjugal discord.
So anyway, conjugal discord.
Right. Well, that was fun.
It was fun. Down the ADD train.
Yeah, right. Red light.
Red light.
But the many other factors probably shape marital behavior. So.
So it's not just about conjugal discord then.
No.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of it. However, he and other scientists said the study is the latest piece of evidence to show that biology, down to the level of individual genes, can play a powerful role in shaping complex human behavior.
Mm.
In other words, if a man's culture, religion, and family background each have a seat at the conference table that determines his attitude toward marital fidelity and monogamy, his genes might well sit at the head of the table.
Yeah, my genes usually do.
We get washed in.
Every now and then I do.
There are many ways this information can help a man and his wife when they marry, said Helen Fisher, a biological anthropologist at Rutgers University who studies romantic love.
Okay. I'm trying to decide which joke to go with.
Leave that right there.
That's right. I had about six of them I was going to try to choose between.
By the way, this article is from the Washington Post. It's not from like some sort of joke paper.
Okay. Not from the Sun or from the
Times or anything like that.
Okay.
Right.
Gotcha. Okay. We're
going to
get sued.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. A man who knows his she had and might be able to use the knowledge to ignore tugs of restlessness he might feel in his marriage.
Yeah. It's hard to ignore those tugs
of
restlessness.
You can say it. Oh, it's just my DNA and I'm going to ignore it.
Hmm.
Does she know she's talking about men?
Yeah, I don't think so.
I mean,
what did
they
say she was? She was a biological anthropologist?
Biological anthropologist.
Yeah, I don't think she understands exactly how men work. I mean, maybe on a genetic level, on a cell level, maybe, but
the brain has a lot
to do with this, too.
Yeah. And a team of scientists studied in a sample of more than 1,000 heterosexual couples regulates the activity of a hormone in the brain known as vasopressin.
Mm-hmm.
It dictates how and where vasopressin receptors are situated in the brain, effectively said Larry J. Young, a psychiatrist who studies the genetics of social behavior at Emory University.
Yeah.
Brain receptors act like locks, and vasopressin acts like a key. The key works only when there is a lock. In the absence of a receptor, vasopressin cannot act.
Ah, I see. Yeah, I hate it when my vasopressin can't act.
Yeah. Something to get shots for.
It is.
About 40% of men have one or two copies of the allele. Warham, a PhD student, said that men with two copies of the allele had a greater risk of marriage. I've already said that. The study asked men in married or long-term relationships whether they had experienced a relationship crisis in the past year that were of such intensity that they considered divorce or splitting. The scientists also asked the wives and partners of the men what it was like to live with them, examining levels of affection, cohesion, consensus, and satisfaction. About 15% of the men without the allele reported serious marital discord.
Mm.
not conjugal, but marital,
mm, okay,
in the past year, compared with 34% of the men who with two copies of the allele. It's almost double the percentage of men.
Wow.
Over double the percentage of men, right?
Wow, yeah.
Wives and partners of the men with two copies of the allele reported lower levels of satisfaction, affection, cohesion, and consensus in the relationship than women married to men who had one or more of the, or no copies of the allele.
Okay, so now, interesting little side note on this one.
Okay.
I don't know whether we've mentioned it here on the podcast or not, but a couple of weeks ago, we took Ian up to Nashville to begin autism testing, right?
Uh-huh.
And, Ian is going to have his genetic code tested,
uh-huh,
at 4. Now, do you think that that gene would show up? I guess it would, wouldn't it? It would show up.
Probably.
So we could have him tested for allele too.
Yeah.
In addition to the genetic variances for autism as well.
Yeah, you can see if his vasopressin is...
He's got a lock or not.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that's kind of, I mean...
You know the cool part about this is, though? And I think I've told you this already, but he's going to be entered into the Human Genome Project database.
Yeah.
I just think that's cool. You know? I mean, I wish it weren't so, but it's just neat. You know?
What is this Human Genome...
The Human Genome Project?
Uh-huh.
I mean, it's the one where they're, you know, decoding all the DNA strands.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we've talked about it, I think, on the show before. The guy with the playwright from the Humana Festival did some research with it, too.
Oh, right.
But they're basically, I mean, it's an ongoing project because, I mean, it's so complex.
Right.
But they've been able to identify, I mean, it's not a, how did the doctor word it? She said it's not a diagnosis, but it can be an indication.
Mm-hmm.
So if Ian, you know, if Ian has certain little genetic flags that pop up that could say autistic, then they'll test Becca and I. And then if we have the same ones, then they'll rule them out and have to start from scratch and all that stuff. But it's just mostly for research than it is, unless I'm autistic and who knows, maybe. But, they're going to do, mostly keeping it for research, not as a diagnosis.
Right. So they're going to do all this and still not know.
No, well, I mean, the psychological tests are what will, he's going to go through, like, I think,
but, I mean,
two or three different psychological tests.
If they do this to mm-hmm. his DNA,
mm-hmm.
and then they find these flags,
mm-hmm.
and then they test you guys,
mm-hmm.
you have the same flag.
Mm-hmm.
What does that prove?
It proves that, well, they'll add it in so that they, if it doesn't necessarily mean it, well, it may be new information that those flags might not necessarily mean autism like they thought before, or, I mean, he'll be added into the, you know, the whole mix of things, and they'll compare that with, you know, other autistic cases and all of those things too. So, I mean, his having his blood drawn and his DNA typed is more about their research,
mm-hmm.
which I'm all for.
Right.
Than it is his diagnosis. His diagnosis is going to come from the psychological and fine motor testing,
mm-hmm.
which we'll do in May, I think.
Right.
Right. Unless we can get it done sooner than that, but yeah. But, yeah, I mean, he went to I can never remember her title. She's a pediatrician. I can't think of what her title is now, but anyway, he went to a pediatrician that specializes in, you know, behavioral issues and those kinds of things.
Right.
And she basically, his diagnosis couldn't say yes or no that he is or he isn't.
Right.
They think he might be high functioning autistic, but. We'll have to wait and see, you know, once we get the fuller testing done. But I was just thinking, since we're having DNA tested.
Right.
Maybe
you
know,
we should check out this gene.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, I won't get mine tested for that way if they have to draw my blood. I won't worry about finding that out. Because that'll just create problems for me, you know.
Right. Well, that'd you know, I mean, be that's an issue you'll have to face.
That's exactly. Well, I don't do the dishes, you know. I don't take out the trash.
Well, it's that gene that you got.
You know, that thing. You know. That's exactly what it'll be. It'll be just like I carry these kids around for 9 months. I'll have that. Then I'll have that also thrown in my face.
10
well.
Months, but yeah.
Yeah. Well, I get 9 months, but that's just what she says.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
But I mean, if you have the gene, it's not about doing the dishes or not doing the dishes.
No, but I'm saying it'll be used against me if the gene is there. You know what I'm saying?
Right, but that's an illogical kind of statement.
I didn't say it wasn't.
You know, I mean, if she's going to throw that in your face, then, you know, you've got to wait for, like, Hannah or something to come over, and then, mm-hmm. then she can throw it in your face.
Right, yeah.
But then you can throw it back and say, well,
right.
It's yep. the way I'm programmed.
Yep. I know. Yeah.
It's to do this thing.
Yeah.
With, mm-hmm. with the genes that I got.
Yep. That's true. You're right. You're right on the money.
Human Genome Project or not. I mean, it's... But I mean,
the thing that this does, if it
turns out to be that Ian, you know, has this gene, and he knows it four.
Yeah. Well,
what's the psychological repercussions?
I would tell him at four, maybe when he's 10, you know, because apparently that's when people really start to grow up.
Apparently. Yeah. Yeah. They're emerging. I think emergent is the term.
Emerging. Yeah. But I mean,
in certain circles anyway.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what I've heard. Mm. But.
Puts him in a whole different pool.
It does. It does.
And
the pool can get really messy too.
It can.
You know, it really can.
Yeah.
Yeah. Diving off the deep end.
more ways than one. So if you're out there and you're a cheater, guys,
get your blood tested.
Yeah. Get your defense ready because, it apparently is genetic.
Well, hey, is that going to start to be used in court?
It's a scientific study that someone could kind of pull in there.
I bet it will be. I bet a couple of it, we'll start seeing that.
So we're going to forget how that affects divorce law.
Divorce cases. Yeah.
And settlements.
Yep.
And this is in heterosexual couples. We talked about the ramifications in homosexual couples.
Right. This is quite literally the proverbial can of worms.
Because I mean, in a homosexual couple, both partners could have the gene. Yeah. Then what happens?
Yeah, I don't know. What happens in same sex female couples?
Well,
neither one of them would have the gene. So what?
They could, but it affects them less, maybe. Because remember, it said the gene affected women less, but I mean, the thing is, right? Maybe we've discovered why relationships seem accelerated in the gay culture.
You may have touched on something. We got a lot more research to do.
I mean, this may actually explain the gay years. Have you heard of gay years? You know,
no, I haven't. But
well, it's like if a regular that's not a right word. If a straight couple.
Mm-hmm. I'll edit that out for you.
Thanks. If a normal, not weird, abomination of God couple, you know.
Well, we are in Tennessee. What are you gonna do?
If you're not going to hell, couple.
Go ahead.
If you're not friends with the terrorist couple.
Sorry. Go ahead.
If you're not a breakdown marriage couple.
Right.
Well, like if a straight couple has a relationship for 6 months, it's like 3 years in gay years, kind of like dog years.
Wow, I don't think I'd have made that analogy either. But
it's known in the gay culture. A lot of my friends talk about gay years.
Wow, I've not heard that. At least not referred to in that sense. I've not heard that term.
So like that's why that apparently, you know, gay relationships are intense and but they tend to happen frequently or
I've never heard that before.
But I think that's because of this gene here.
I think it's because of this too.
As a matter of fact,
the vasopressin.
We've got to get back on our research here. We've got to get back to work.
Yeah. We've got to
Do you have all those blood samples over there?
Yeah. Let me.
I
got a little sample here.
Yeah. Just do the. Put that one. This one's, I dehydrated this one.
We gotta have for storage and everything.
Well, right? I know. Yeah, I mean, they gotta figure out the way to keep them the most. Yeah, put that on tight because I don't want that spilling out everywhere.
Yeah, we put that on the thing there.
So we'll have to report back
that stuff up.
We'll definitely have to report back on the. What are you doing?
What?
What are you?
I'm just sorry.
You didn't just. Did you? Now we have to start all over.
Well, you can go about collecting more urine samples. I'm gonna not.
Yeah, you can go back to your research about gay couples there.
I'm gonna go back to my gay theory. My abomination before God relationship study.
If
If you like what you hear on the Inexplicable Dumb Show, why not take a minute or two to fill out our listener survey? By filling out this anonymous survey, you make it possible for us to attract potential advertisers so we can keep bringing you our show for free. Go to our website and click the listener survey button to start now. www.inexplicabledumbshow.com.
Juzu.
What?
It's Juzu. That's what I call this episode, remember?
Juzu.
Yeah. I mean, I'm probably mispronouncing it, but, you know.
How do you spell it?
J-U-Z-U.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
So you're not making some sort of ethnic joke?
No. Mm-mm. Nope. No.
Okay, I mean that.
But they are...
for you to be offensive.
Well, far be it from me. But anyway, they're Buddhist prayer beads, is what they are.
And let me guess, there are probably like 108 of them,
mm-hmm.
including the head bead.
Mm-hmm. Careful how you say that, though. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah, it's kind of like the rosary in a way, but a little bit different.
Less Catholic.
Yeah, a lot less Catholic.
Right. So the beads represent Hindu names for gods, right?
Yes, but they also are a way, just like the rosary is, they're a way for you to count the number of, you know, prayers or meditations that you're supposed to do, so you can, you know, count them off that way.
Yeah, so. Because you're supposed to name all 108 mm-hmm. yep. Hindu gods.
Right.
Right.
Yep. Mm-hmm. So, didn't go too far off the reservation here for 108. What do you got for
108? Well, I mean, for Methodist from just, Alabama,
that's,
I guess,
true.
Going that, to Hindu land is a,
yeah.
I was off the reservation.
I was walking some thin ice here, my friend. What do you got for 109?
Worried about utter damnation.
That's, yeah, I know. Yeah, well, but that's the, you know, those, that's the kind of risk taker that I am.
Yeah.
What do you got for 109?
109 is going to be called Fair Youth.
As in F-A-I-R? Fair Youth?
Fair as in fair play youth.
Okay. Awkward, but okay, that's fine.
I'm just thinking of your Labor Day. That's
well, I know. I know you are. I know you are. And I appreciate that. Really do. All right, let's wrap it up.
Okay. All right, so we want to thank Jeffrey Sherman from the Alabama Shakespeare Festival for coming on and talking to us during our Juzu episode.
Mm-hmm.
That's just fun to say Juzu.
It is, isn't it?
It's, yeah, it's kind of fun.
Yeah.
So I also hope, you know,
I've learned quite a few things.
I hope the gene defense,
yeah.
You know, will help you out.
Yep. Well, one always needs a good pair of jeans.
Right.
You know,
and apparently you can have two, and
you can
cause problems.
Yeah, I know.
So yeah, that'll be fun.
Mm-hmm.
That should be fun.
Yep.
I want to take this special time.
Okay.
This is a
little closing moment. You want some music?
Closing moment. Yeah.
Okay.
Closing moment. I want to take this opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
This moment, if you the listener, mm-hmm. will indulge me.
Okay.
I would like to take this opportunity to wish my wife a happy birthday.
Wow.
Because the day that this goes live will be her birthday.
Her birthday?
Yes. Her
1924
birthday.
Very good.
So I do want to say to her, happy birthday, honey, and I love you. And I don't have the gene that T has.
That has not been proven. Well, congratulations to her.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, for being born all those years ago. I mean, that didn't come out quite right. Let me say, just tell her happy birthday as well for me.
Yeah, I will.
Yeah. I didn't get her anything.
That was okay. Well, you missed the anniversary, so what would
I didn't miss ours, though.
Yes, you did.
Oh, shit, I did.
Okay. Yeah, that's the one I'm talking about.
Yeah, you're right.
Yep.
I'm never.
Nope.
Never.
Nope.
Not for this full calendar year am I going mm-hmm. to live that one down.
Nope.
It's a very odd relationship we have, though, you know that?
Yep.
Yep. All right, well, happy birthday, Tara. Hey, we'll see you.
Bye.
This podcast is a member of the Blueberry Network. Blueberry. No E's. That's Blueberry, BLUBRRY.com. Blueberry.com.
Pop Alternative Media.